Welcome to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Bob Dancer is America's premier video poker writer and teacher. He's written 10 books, including Video Poker for the Intelligent Beginner and the best-selling Million Dollar Video Poker. He helped develop the computer software Video Poker for Winners, and in 2004, he was inducted into the Video Poker Hall of Fame. Richard Munchkin has been a professional Advantage player for over 30 years and is in the Blackjack Hall of Fame. His book, Gambling Wizards, Conversations with the World's Greatest Gamblers, is a testament to the many ways you can succeed at gambling. The goal of the show is that you'll be a more knowledgeable gambler tomorrow than you were yesterday. And now, here are Bob and Richard.
Good afternoon. Welcome to Gambling with an Edge. I'm Bob Dancer.
And I'm Richard Munchkin.
We have two guests today. For the first 15 minutes of the show, we'll be talking to Jeffrey Compton, publisher of CDCGamingReports.com, on casino news of interest to smart players. Following talking to Jeffrey, we'll be talking to John Finkel, a world champion at Magic the Gathering, who has since moved on to blackjack, poker, sports betting, and now hedge fund training. Jeffrey Compton, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you for having me.
There have been some arrests recently about players with dealer help winning over $1 million at craps at the Bellagio by making phony hop bets. What do you know about this?
Well, I guess a pair of Bellagio crap dealers and two friends of theirs have, over the period of 2 years, have gotten over $1 million at the crap tables via hop bets that were never made but paid anyway. Now, for the benefit of the five members of your audience and one of your guests who does not know what a hop bet is or doesn't really know, could you explain?
Yeah, so a hop bet is a one-roll bet on a specific combination of the dice. So the most common hop bets are the 11 or the 12 or the aces or the ace deuce. But in some casinos, you're allowed to bet on literally any combination. So, I might want to bet a Michael Jordan, a 23, and so for one roll, if 23 comes up, and it would pay 15 to 1. So apparently what they were doing is the player would throw in some money and say, "Hey," and the dealer would say, "Bet." And now the dice would hit, and they'd say, "23." And he'd say, his hop bet was on 23, and pay him.
For a $4,000 bet.
Yeah. Well, I don't know if they take $4,000 on that. I don't know how much they'll take. A lot of places, I don't know what they'll take at the Bellagio. But, yeah, they were apparently betting quite a lot.
Okay, to prove that they were cheating, to say, this is obviously cheating, the MGM had somebody calculate the actual odds of winning, something like 452 billion to one. Now, I haven't seen the calculations, and so I can't vouch for the numbers, but let's say it was 452 million to one instead of 452 billion. Why did it take 2 years to catch these guys?
Yeah, it's just...
I have theories. One, I assume that the craps tables at the Bellagio are the busiest in handle in probably Las Vegas. Second, they probably have more players who make proposition bets and hop bets because they think it's sexy. Okay, this is my guessing. And probably management does not watch the crap tables as carefully as they watch the blackjack tables and the baccarat tables.
Well, the other thing
so
is,
that's
in
my
the old,
guess. But
in the old days, all crap tables had a box man who sat there at the table. Now, there's been this move in the last few years to get rid of the box man.
Labor savings.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you save money really well with that idea. But it also just goes to show you the ludicrousness of wasting time and energy on looking for card counters when the vast majority of money that is being lost by casinos that they could stem is coming from people who actually work in the casinos.
So,
all right. Daily Fantasy Sports. We seem to be talking about this almost every week. It's a widely believed there was an exemption carved out in the UIGEA, Unlawful Internet Gaming Enforcement Act, saying fantasy sports were not gambling. It's a ridiculous argument that they're not gambling, but we're stuck with it. In the past week, an essay from Professor I. Nelson Rose, an occasional guest on our show, said that this might not be the case. The UIGEA says up front, no provision of this subchapter shall be construed as altering, limiting, or extending any federal or state law or tribal state compact prohibiting, permitting, or regulating gambling within the United States. It's easy to read that phrase in a way that says if other laws say daily fantasy sports are illegal, and the Wire Act definitely says that, the UIGEA doesn't provide any exemption at all for it. This is a doorway for Congress to shut down daily fantasy sports if they want. Do you think they will?
Just yesterday, former Representative Jim Leach, he's the guy who drafted that section, okay? It came out and said that in no way were they thinking of the current situation coming out of it, where with DraftKings and FanDuel and $99 million worth of advertising and that level of play. I mean, it was ludicrous that they were it would be ludicrous to think that that's what they were doing.
Yeah, I have absolutely no sympathy for Lynch, because all he was thinking about was whoever was paying him to write the bill in the first place.
Maybe that. Remember, fantasy sports has been with us in some way or form for almost half a century. When I was in college, there was my roommate and a bunch of other baseball nerds used to play Strat-O-Matic baseball, and they'd all have teams. It was very complex. And it wasn't just one night with beer. I mean, this was a series of games and scheduled games over a period of the whole semester. And so my feeling was that at the time they put in that exemption, there was just a feeling of this isn't that big a deal and it never will be.
Well, but they also put in an exemption for horse racing, you know, which is clearly gambling. They never thought, you know, that horse racing wasn't gambling. It's just they got paid by the horse racing industry. So
I'm going to play devil's advocate here. Okay. If I participate in a golf match this weekend and I win first prize, which is $100,000, am I gambling? The first prize is $100,000.
Are you paying an entry fee?
Yes. Possibly, yes.
Yeah, I would call that gambling.
That's gambling, yes.
That's gambling, because a lot of people would say, no, that's a game of skill. Okay, I'm not betting the other players. I'm just entering a golf tournament, and if I get the best score through skill for golf, we all agree golf is not a luck
game. This is the argument that FanDuel and DraftKings are trying to make.
I know. They also said that they compared it to chess, and I've been looking online for some time for competitive chess games.
Well,
it hasn't worked.
Video poker is a game of skill, and that's definitely gambling. Poker is a game of skill. That's gambling. Sports betting is a game of skill. That's gambling. So they all have skill, luck and skill element. But if there's any of the luck element into it, it is gambling. Chess has basically no luck element into it. Chess is not gambling.
But you can enter a tournament and pay an entry fee in chess and win money. I mean,
okay. Well, my point is that there is a counter argument. Many people are saying why it's, of course, it's gambling. Do you want my honest opinion? I think it's gambling. But there is a counter argument out there that it is not gambling.
Not a good counter argument.
Yeah, it's the one that lawyers are paid to come up with, right? If they could find a better one.
Now, my guess is that Congress will move on this. Why? Because it's something they all agree on.
Well, we're going to have a new Speaker of the House, and so Mr. Adelson is trying to get his guy in there, who's anti-internet gaming of all sorts, and if that's the new Speaker of the House, daily fantasy sports is on the agenda, my guess is.
Yeah.
Well, but also this is coming up in the states. And I think the states are going to decide a lot of this.
Well, the states' comeback will probably is to expand legal sports betting because they get money from legal sports betting. They don't get money from DraftKings and them, except for, you know, if they pay state income taxes in one odd state.
Yeah.
But so you will see, in my guess, you will see federal legislation against it, but it will also, I think, lead to an expansion of sports betting.
I hope the
sports leagues, the NFL and them, lose total credibility by supporting this and being so against legal sports betting.
Yeah, at least the NBA has said, we're in favor of gambling.
Okay.
Millennials, which by some definition includes people currently between the ages of 11 and 33, which leaves three members of this show out. They present a different casino market than their parents and grandparents do. Casinos are now marketing to this younger group. Are they going too far? Jeffrey?
The initial discussion, which started about a year ago and was somewhat started by the then under 40 president of the AGA, was that most people who play slots start about the ages of 35, 40, 45. So the initial discussion was, when the millennials hit that age, will the games be there for them? That was the initial discussion. Right now, there are more millennials in the strip casinos than there were boomers 30 years ago. Okay? They are there for the clubs. They are there for the rooms. They're there for the restaurants. They're there for some of the shows, of which they pay full price. Okay, so they're already there. So the initial object is to make sure there are games on the floor when they're there. Unfortunately, a lot of the discussion has been get the millennials into the casino now. And some of the things have been suggested would offend, in my opinion, the current crowd that is in there. Such as a good example would be changing the music over the loudspeaker. Okay? That's a simplistic example, but you can get the idea. When I first moved here, which is, I think, about the time Bob first moved here, there was a whole discussion of Las Vegas for families. Remember that one?
Yeah.
Until they figured out that families were a lousy audience and that they offended the current crowd. So I think that the push for millennials, I'm all for getting them into the casino at the normal age, but I don't think we have to redo the entire casino tomorrow to get them in.
All right, got a couple minutes left. Slot payouts are getting tighter across the country. Casino profits are going down across the country. Is one of these causing the other?
Yes. The recession hit the casinos hard. And one of the ways, according to a report done by the Association of Gaming Equipment Managers, which is referred to as AGEM, did a report showing that machines have been tightened, machine holds have been tightened over the years, okay, over the last few years, much more dramatically than the years prior to the recession. But profits and handle and that thing have not gone up, in some cases have gone down. So the tightening did not save anybody any money. The one thing, now there were a couple of factors for that tightening that were not just management making the decision to tighten it. A lot of it was caused by the introduction of penny slots, which are naturally tighter. They shouldn't be, but they tend to be. And the addition of more games, which are participation, which the casino rents instead of owns. The life cycles of machines are a lot shorter.
Okay. But do you think that the recession caused them to tighten, or do you think that the tightening caused the handles to go down?
I think what happened is the recession caused the handles to go down, as you know, the Great Recession caused the handles to go down and the profits to go down, and the companies reacted by tightening some of the machines, okay, or tightening the general hold, and they have not seen a bounce back, and because the holds have been tightened.
Right, yeah. So okay. Jeff Wang wrote a good article for The Motley Fool about just sort of the basic economics. When you make something more expensive, the demand becomes less.
And yes.
So, yeah, I would blame a lot of that on a lot of their reduced revenue on their tightening everything, not just the slots, but the table games as well.
That's true. And so.
Thank you, Jeffrey. We've been talking to Jeffrey Compton, publisher of CDC Gaming Reports. We appreciate your insight. Look forward to your next visit on the show. Well, now we're going to talk to our second guest, John Finkel. John Finkel became world champion at Magic the Gathering almost 20 years ago. Until I started preparing for this show, I had never even heard of this game. When he became 21, John drifted to poker, blackjack, and sports handicapping. Today, he works as an analyst for a hedge fund company. John Finkel, welcome to Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be joining you on Gambling with an Edge.
Thank you, John. In a few minutes, explain what's involved in playing Magic the Gathering. How is that similar, and how is it different from what Advantage players do in other games?
Sure. So Magic is a... There are a couple different ways to describe it. The way that... I guess it sounds the highest. Is sort of a mix of bridge and chess and poker, or the way that maybe is is a little bit simpler is it's sort of like adult Pokemon. It's
That doesn't help me. I don't know Pokemon either. But okay, go ahead.
I do understand bridge and
honest,
chess.
I've actually never played a game of Pokemon myself.
Uh huh.
But I know that it was made as a simplistic version of Magic. To tie in with a cartoon, but Magic. It's a strategy based card game. You have one opponent. The primary way to win is you each have 20 life points. You reduce them to zero, and you do it through a deck of cards that you've pre-selected and decide to bring to a tournament. 60 cards each with a 15 card bench or sideboard. And at its heart, it's a game of probability, of resources, of management. It's kind of a bit like backgammon where you're making a lot of choices that are statistically correct, but often in the game might end up being the wrong choice, whereas the less correct choice would have helped you to win the game. It's also similar where the better player can often lose to the less skilled player, but on average, they're going to win.
And can you, do you still play at all anymore?
Yeah, I started to play somewhat seriously again a few years ago. I got voted into, they have a Magic Hall of Fame. I got voted into it in 2007 in the first class, or maybe it was 2006. And one of the things that gives you lifetime qualification to the major events. They have four majors every year. This year, the four are Madison, Honolulu, and Sydney. It's actually interesting. I'm actually right outside Milwaukee. The first major is coming up this weekend, starting on Friday, in Milwaukee. So I'm actually talking to you from a house with about a dozen other Magic players who are preparing for this tournament that's starting in a few days.
And what kind of money can you win in the tournament nowadays?
So I believe that the annual prize purse for tournaments is somewhere in the $5 million range. I'm not sure exactly. They'll have four major tournaments with about $250,000 each. They'll have about 40 minor tournaments with about 75K each. And then they have another couple sort of end-of-the-year tournaments that you have to score high enough or be a national team to make that I think each have a couple hundred grand each.
It's better than backgammon.
It's the sort of thing where, there are a lot of people who can make, a sort of mid-five-figure, living, or at least some people playing it. That's not really why I'm necessarily here. I'm here because I think it's a great game, it's a lot of fun, and I like competing. Maybe in a similar way to how, a lot of people go play in big poker tournaments. Even though they don't need to play poker professionally, or even if they aren't winning players.
Sure, and I mean, I still go to a backgammon tournament occasionally, mostly just to see. I'm sure you must have dozens of friends who are at the tournaments that you get to see that you may not otherwise.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I'll be honest. My favorite parts is, you know, I kind of play with a team of people that prepare together. The games themselves are individual, but the tournaments are sort of like a marketing tool for the manufacturer of the game, which is Wizards of the Coast. It's a subsidiary of Hasbro, and what they'll do is they'll come with a new set of cards, and then in 3 weeks there'll be the first real tournament of any size that's where those cards are legal. So there's a lot of prep work that has to be done right beforehand. So, you know, prepping with other people, such other talented people, you know, really gives a large advantage. You know, it's kind of like if you were playing chess, you know, but every you know, 3 months, you know, they took out four of the pieces and replaced them with four new pieces, and now you have to sort of learn how to play the game again, you know, in a couple of weeks.
You played some poker. Did you find success at poker easier or more difficult than success at Magic?
You know, in some ways it was easier. In some ways it was more difficult. You know, I was lucky. You know, I started playing poker really at the beginning of the boom of internet poker. You know, I was actually 20 when I started playing. And, you know, it was a time when it was very easy to make, you know, a lot of money, you know, playing poker. You know, you could play online. The games were very soft. You could play multiple tables at once. You know, I would play live. I would do well there. I would, you know, play in tournaments. So, you know, my highest winnings ever from Magic were, I think, just over 100 grand a couple of years. You know, whereas that's just through the size.
You know, you're cut, John. You're cutting in and out. I don't know if it's a bad internet connection.
I'm sorry about that. No, I'm actually on my phone because I don't know, there was actually an issue where I couldn't hear you guys on the internet. So it was easier to make the money playing poker, but a lot of that was because there was a lot more money. The games were easier. You know, it was the boom of the internet era. But it was even, you know, harder to maybe get to be the, the best poker player in the world or one of the absolute best, because there's more people competing. You know, one thing that is true, though, is that, you know, almost any very good Magic player who's gotten into playing poker has done very, very well for themselves, whereas there isn't really much in the way of people who are strong poker players who got into Magic and ended up doing well there. So, you know, it's, you know, I mean, the Magic players in the world of poker include, like, David Williams, Eric Frolic, Brock Parker, Justin Bonomo, Gabriel Nassif. You know, there's a whole list of people, you know, who are serious Magic players first who got into playing poker.
You now work for a hedge fund company. Do you consider that a form of advantage gambling?
I do. You know, one of the partners there, you know, my official title is a trader. You know, we started back in the end of 2006. You know, it's just a couple million dollars. And, you know, we all came from, you know, advantage gaming backgrounds. You know, my other partners, you know, my own partner, Kirk, was a phenomenal poker player. He would actually tell me how to play poker. He was a physicist. You know, he was, you know, on the large blackjack team that I was on. He was the guy who did all the math there. My other partner, Larry, was, you know, was very strong. Poker player, also made money on sports. Alex also played poker and being blackjack. You know, there's really a lot of the same sort of thinking goes into both of them. You know, and it's definitely true. I mean, people say this, but, you know, the markets are in some ways, you know, the largest casino in the world.
I would think your competitors in the markets would be actually easier targets than the competitors in a Magic final. But I'm not sure that's true. Would you think that?
Yeah. I mean, in some ways, yes. You know, the thing is that there's like a wide range of additional skills that are necessary for dealing well in the market. I mean, things like, you know, building relationships. There are a wide range of other skills that are useful, you know, and necessary in the financial markets. You know, you need to be a good fundraiser. You need to have good people skills. You need to be able to negotiate deals. You know, you need to do a lot of things other than, you know, just be a really strong game player. You know, I mean, one of the problems we ran into with our fund was that we were very good at the game playing aspect of it early on, but none of us were natural marketers. None of us had connections. None of us had contacts. You know, we did a piss poor job, you know, in terms of actually growing our fund as a business. You know, and this is one of the real major differences. I think a problem that maybe other people would run into if they're moving from, you know, a different form of advantage gambling, you know, into trying to go and use those skills in the marketplace.
So I want to say to our listeners, so there's a really interesting book about John called Johnny Magic and the Card Shark Kids. And there's a link to it on the Gambling with an Edge Facebook page that I highly recommend. So you can learn about a lot of this kind of stuff. It's really a good read. But I also want to get into, you played on one of the biggest blackjack teams in the world, which in your book, it was called The Lawyers. In Josh Axelrad's book, it was called Mossad. But basically, you guys played with the big player routine and would bet three hands of 10,000 when you wonged in. And I want to know, how did you get involved with that team, and what was your experience like?
Yeah, so when I was 20 years old, I saw the movie Rounders, and I said, you know, I think I can do this. And so I got really into playing poker. You know, it was a bit of hubris, but it turned out I was right. And I walked into the Diamond Club in New York. The Diamond Club was an underground poker club. My understanding is actually Teddy KGB's club was loosely based on it. And there was where I met actually two of my future partners, Kirk and Alex, who I mentioned earlier. And they were both involved in the blackjack team. Not really that seriously at that point, but a couple of years later, when I was actually 22, they, you know, they began to expand and had this idea of, you know, really sort of going at it in a professional, you know, business-like organized fashion. And so they recruited me. You know, it was the summer, I guess I just turned 22. It was probably about June of 2000. You know, I did some studying, I did some practice in New York, and then I flew out to Vegas, you know, for my first trip. And yeah, I mean, it was, you know, it was amazing. It was, you know, it was a world that I never really, you know, knew existed.
And I assume if you were 22, you were not a BP, you were doing call-ins?
Yeah, I mean, at first, you know, I was very young. I probably seemed even younger than I was. I know they questioned whether or not I would ever be able to BP. So, yeah, I mean, I was just, you know, doing call-ins. You know, I was able to pick up the technical aspects very quickly, you know, before we're all there. So for about my first three quarters of a year, actually being a big player. But, you know, it's a thing where events rotates through it. You know, I'm much more comfortable in a casino, and eventually they let me, you know, go ahead and bet the money. Then I spent the next, you know, basically playing, you know, whichever role made the most sense for me, you know, given the casino and the game, you know, that we were playing.
You know, you're starting to cut in and out again. So if you moved, go back to where you were before.
No, I didn't. I'm sorry for these difficulties. I guess I should have tested them more. You know, I'm out here in Milwaukee.
Yeah. So a couple of things were really unusual about that team. One of them was you guys never used an assumed name, and you always cashed out completely and got the CTR, and you also had the sort of your modus operandi was just to play until you were thrown out. Can you talk a little more about that?
Yes. So, I mean, if we were BPing in the casino, you know, we always, I mean, we never used fake ID. We would always, you know, cash out in our real name. You know, the heads of the team, a lot of them actually had significant legal experience. You know, they'd left the world of corporate law to be gamblers instead. And so, you know, they wanted to make sure that we were always, you know, completely on the right side of anything legally, you know, should there ever be any trouble. And I think that understanding probably helps a lot with casinos. You know, I mean, they did a couple of sketchy little things here and there, but nothing really that bad at all. You know, so obviously if you were just someone who was counting there, you know, I didn't feel the need to say, you know, hi, my name is John. You know, if somebody asked my name, I might say whatever, you know, if I'm just some guy betting $25. But you know, if you're betting the money, you know, no fake IDs, you know, and you know, you're going to use your real name and make sure that, you know, because the IRS has to find out about it. And you don't want to be in the business of providing false information to the IRS. And yeah, and in terms of, you know, how we played, yeah, we were very aggressive. You know, there are a lot of casinos in the country. There are a lot of big players you can run through there. You know, there's a limited amount of money we want to spend doing this. So, you know, it just made sense to, you know, extract the most value from the casinos, you know, per hour. For other people in other situations, maybe that doesn't make sense. You know, maybe there's somebody who's outside Foxwoods and they're letting them win a couple $100 a hand with some high, you know, with some, you know, high cover game, and, you know, maybe that's right for them. But for us, we decided that, you know, if we weren't getting kicked out ever, then we just weren't playing a strong enough game.
You know, I think a lot of people will find it hard to believe, but back then, you guys could actually walk up to a table and bet three hands of 10,000 in the middle of a shoe, and they would take that. I mean, for some period of time back then.
Yeah, I mean, you know, three hands of 10,000 was definitely the upper, you know, end of a wager. I mean, I never actually personally bet three hands of 10,000. The highest I ever got up to was 8,000. You know, a lot of that would just be very casino dependent. You know, there are maybe a few casinos, you know, I think maybe Bellagio, maybe Caesars, that would take it. You know, it's not going to be your very first bet, but if you've already, you know, some money and, you know, they had your name and all of that, you know, then yeah, we would do that. You know, if they're just kind of, there's just free money on the table, you know, we want to take it. And okay, yeah, you're going to kick me out, but, you know, in a month I'll be back. I'll be, you know, I've grown out my beard. I'll, you know, colored my hair. I'll be wearing glasses. I'll be sitting there. There'll be somebody else who's here betting the money who you've never seen before. And they're going to do that until you kick them out. And then in another couple months, there'll be somebody new. And, you know, that makes a lot more sense than sort of just half-assing it and doing your best to not be scary to them, but only making 25% of the hourly rate that you'd make if you were being really aggressive.
There was a story in the book that happened at the Four Queens on a New Year's Eve. They had a very beatable shuffle, and you were killing them, and your philosophy of your team seemed to be keep going until they kick us out, but for some reason you voluntarily left that night. You quit them before they made you quit. What happened?
Yeah, the Four Queens, man. So the Four Queens was in downtown Las Vegas, so, you know, it's not on the Strip. You know, we didn't have a game there, and I was the first person who'd ever like, attack their shuffle, so they didn't know what they were looking for.
We're losing you again.
Winning, and there's Queens, you know, it was one of, I'm going to walk over here, maybe this will help a little bit.
That seems better.
I don't know if it's better over here.
Yeah, it's better.
So, yeah, so the four Queens, you know, seen in downtown Vegas, not on the Strip. You know, it's sort of a place that probably used to be a lot better, but it,
that's for sure,
you know, kind of faded a little bit with, you know, with the downtown area. You know, they still had Hugo's Cellar, which was at that point, you know, one of the top few restaurants in Las Vegas. And, you know, since I was the first person to attack their shuffle, you know, their max is only $1,000 a hand, so they didn't really get a ton of advantage play. You know, I was the first person they'd seen there, and so, you know, they let me play for trip after trip after trip. You know, but on some level, they also didn't really like me. You know, they were worried. Maybe they kind of guessed something was up. You know, they get really paranoid, and obviously, like, I'm winning, I keep it coming back, and I'm winning, and they're waiting for me to lose. You know, and then this one trip, I'd start to lose. I was down, I don't know, probably $50,000 or something. And then on the, you know, there's a lot of variance. And then this one day, I just went on, you know, an insane run. You know, they'd, it was funny, they'd only had $500 out on the tables. And for the first time ever, they broke out their $1,000 chips for me because I cleared a rack. And they actually, it sounds weird, but they only had 100 of these.
They only had 100 $1,000 chips?
They did, because they mostly just ever used purples. Like, literally, like, they physically took them out of, like, a plastic wrap thing or whatever that they were in. And these are the chips. And I won all of them, right? And, you know, normally, you know, we're a situation where, yeah, like, we're going to play and the casino kicks us out. But this is really a consideration of heat and about, you know, maximizing, you know, your win at a casino. It doesn't have to do with, you know, other potential issues. And the issue here was that it was getting pretty late on New Year's Eve. There were a lot of people seeing me. You know, I had a few $100,000 on the table in front of me. You know, there's a lot of shady characters. You know, it goes pretty nuts on New Year's Eve. It's, like, impossible to get out of there. You know, the casino themselves were, you know, they were kind of freaking out. You know, it's sort of place that maybe they would do something sketchy. You know, maybe not. You know, probably not, but you never really know. And, you know, so I showed actually, to be honest, for my age, I'm surprised that I thought, hey, maybe I should get out of there, because at that point I was, you know, I was the least risk-averse person you'll ever meet. You know, so I called back to the house. I was like, look, guys, I have all these chips. It's going great. I'm just worried that they're going to kick me out of here at, you know, 11:30 at night, and I'm gonna, you know, maybe looking at a hard time cashing out. No one can get down here. You know, tell me I won't be able to get out of here. You know, maybe I'm trying to get out of here, and someone who saw me, you know, knows I have 300 grand on me, you know, or maybe more. I don't remember how much I had exactly. You know, and is gonna after me and try to, you know, get the money and maybe hurt me. You know, I think that maybe this is the one time that I can still get out of here physically. I should just take the chips, turn them into cash, and get out of here, you know, so it doesn't get dangerous later on. You know, and they agreed. So, you know, it is a little bit sad that I didn't play there and they finally kicked me out, you know, but you know, I think it was probably the right choice.
Yeah, you had to settle for a lousy 100 grand. They didn't have any chocolate ones they could have unwrapped?
Yeah, at the Four Queens.
No.
Well, across the street they have them. We got about 7 more minutes. In the show, in the book, Johnny Magic and the Card Shark Kid, you start out to be a smart, fat Jewish kid from New Jersey, and you were regularly beaten up by the other kids, and basically you never got laid. So you discover magic. Over time, you become best in the world at it and gradually lose weight and become a good-looking guy. One part of the book I found interesting was that since you were such a non-starter at getting a girlfriend, you decided to read a How to Pick Up Women book, and you studied it assiduously.
But isn't that what any advantage player would do, right?
It worked. Yeah. Now, this particular book must be more than 15 years old now. Do you still think it would be useful to any listeners who aren't experiencing success in the dating world?
You know, maybe. I read it was more stuff online, you know, and I think that the most important part of it was, you know, getting out there, you know, just doing it, being aware that you could try things and you're going to fail and becoming comfortable with failure, sort of, you know, learning, you know, what that looks like. You know, it's sort of like anything else. And, you know, I mean, I think in the end it was very helpful because I got very comfortable in a lot of these situations. And, you know, I mean, part of it also, you know, as you get older, you know, when you're a man, you know, these things do get easier. You know, I've been somewhat successful. You know, that helped as well. You know, the thing that I really missed the most about it was that, you know, I would regularly go out and do things that put me, like, really outside my comfort zone. You know, it's shocking how much just going up and talking to, you know, a complete stranger in a bar can be a really scary thing where you just have this fear, even though you know on some level that there's really nothing that bad that can happen. You know, it's just incredibly hard to do, and it's incredibly scary, at least it was for me. And, you know, getting over that, you know, I think was great. And I especially just love that idea of doing something to put me outside of my comfort zone over and over and over again. You know, I think that's really where you get the largest amount of personal growth.
So you approached it like a numbers game. Right, the more trials you have, the better your chance of success.
You know, so I think that's somewhat true, but I think the more important part is sort of building up a skill set and just sort of building up a familiarity with things, and also just not being scared. You know what I mean? It's more the situation where when you know you want to be in a place where when the right situation comes up, you got to take advantage of it.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, sure, like numbers help. It's anything else, like you know, you're going to try to play basketball. Or, you know, do a bunch of other things. It's a great one. Just, you know, like, hey, I'll try enough and it'll work. It's, you know, learning to grow about, you know, as to who you are, you know, realize that, you know, you have to offer things, you know, as well in these interactions. You know, you want to, you know, grow as a person and be the right person, you know, for when the time comes.
So you had a date through OkCupid that went kind of viral. You want to tell that story?
Yeah, I mean, it's kind of funny. So, you know, in my late 20s, especially my early 30s, you know, I got, you know, I was in New York, I was, you know, pretty successful, and I'd gotten pretty good at meeting people, and so, you know, I was a, you know, pretty big serial dater, you know, I had girlfriends here and there, you know, and then years ago, I went out on a date with, you know, on OkCupid, it was a girl who worked at Gizmodo, it was one of the Gawker sublogs, you know, and I don't know, we went out on a date, went to there was the New York Fringe Festival. And one of the shows that looked interesting to me was a one-man show. It was a black comedy about the life of Jeffrey Dahmer. It was like a show.
That sounds like a great idea for a first date. Let's go see a guy chop off body parts.
Yeah, you know, part of the thing is, and I think this is actually one of the things that I learned, is that you don't want to spend as much time trying to think like, oh, like, the perfect date. What's the best thing I can do? It's like, just go out and do something that's like fun or different or interesting, and you're going to learn way more about the other person. They're going to learn more about you than if you're just doing the stereotypical, you know, let's grab a drink. You know, that's not to say that I don't meet a lot of people over, but you know, if there's some of these things interesting, like, hey, you might as well do it. You know, if they like it too, it's going to be like a great date. And if you don't like it too, then it's going to be a bad date, but that was probably the probably, you know. So yeah, so, you know, we did that. You know, she messaged me a couple times after that. I hadn't really been, you know, it didn't really hit off that much, but it worked on the corner. I was like, okay, yeah, let's go out again. Let's hang out. We went out again. Still no real chemistry. And then, you know, 3 weeks later, there's this article that comes out. And, you know, all of a sudden, you know, I head home from work and I get home and there's, you know, 50 emails about it. And, you know, I'm like, I'm the top trending thing on Reddit, you know, and I'm all over the place. And I'm just, you know, it was pretty nuts. And I mean, it was lucky for me. I mean, at that point, I was, I think, probably 33 or 34. And, you know, I had more confidence in these areas. So, you know, I was like, all right, you know, this, you know, I don't want to say that much about me. You know, if I'd been like 24 or something, it probably would have been a lot worse.
Yeah, just for our listeners, I should point out that what happened was the girl ended up writing this article basically saying she Googled you and found out he was, you know, a magic world championship of magic, and basically kind of painted you as a big nerd who took her to see a play about Jeffrey Dahmer on the first date. And, you know, I have to say that when I read the article, it looked to me like, as someone who does some writing, it looked to me like somebody who has to produce a column and just needed a topic to write about. Because I think most of the people who would read the article would sort of think the girl was kind of the, you know, the one who – I thought less of the girl than I thought of John after reading the article.
Yeah, I mean, that was kind of what the internet decided as well. You know, it was – you know, there were tons of comments on – it was Gizmodo and also Jezebel, which is always Fox, for Gawker. And even there, it was like, you know, everybody was like, you know, what's wrong? You're saying this guy was a nerd? He seems kind of cool. He took this interesting thing. Like, you know, like, what the hell, you know? And yeah, so, I mean, you know, there's like a huge internet backlash against her, you know, and I was very temporarily internet famous. You know, the one nice thing is I've actually really good friends with one of the founders of OkCupid. He reached out to me. Oh. And you know, it turned out that he was a you know that he played some magic himself, you know, not that seriously. So we had like mutual friends in common. So he reached out to me, you know, we met up, you know, and basically I was playing, you know, I like to play magic. I played a lot of basketball. He liked to play basketball. I liked to play other games, you know, and yeah, we become pretty good friends, you know. And I play this other game.
We got about 30 seconds left. If you had to expand your hedge fund, would you hire magic players? Would you give them priority when you're hiring?
You know, I probably would. I certainly would to some extent. You know, so I think magic players are very well suited for like pure technical for trading roles. So, for example, like a lot of options traders, like that sort of thing that magic players are really great at. You know, there's like Susquehanna International Group, which is the largest options trading firm, and they have a number of, you know, magic players that play that work there.
They also recruit a lot of bridge and backgammon players.
Yeah, exactly. You know, for us, we need people with a lot of strong technical skills. You know, we tend to be, you know, we're quantitative, so you need some pretty good math skills. And I have found a lot of magic players tend to be very bright thinkers, very good thinking about things, but a lot of them are also sort of people who don't end up going in for, you know, the years of higher education and stuff like that. They're necessary to develop those skills. However, that being said, if there was a magic player that had those skills, it would certainly be a massive, you know, massive plus. You know, we hired one guy out of Rutgers who's a physicist there. You know, and part of the reason why we liked him was because he'd actually written a program for a heads-up poker bot to play people heads-up poker, and it was actually a pretty good bot. And we were like, okay, you know, he has the skills, he can program, you know, he's a physics background, you know, and he knows how to think about games, and he even wrote a bot that actually plays pretty good heads-up poker. You know, so, I mean, that was like a major, major plus in our mind.
Yeah, I would think that would be good. Thank you, John Finkel. Thank you for taking time. Good luck with future OkCupid dates.
All right. Well, thank you very much for having me on.
The South Point has more than 10,000 games, returning more than 99%. It's more than anybody else has. The promotion October is called Swipe, Spin, and Win. play 300 points each day between Sunday and Wednesday and spin the virtual wheel. Prizes range from 2,500 points, worth $7.50, to $50 in free play. They do have a mystery prize sometimes. Currently, it's an Aero knife, A-E-R-O, or a pseudo Tupperware set. Tomorrow's free video poker class is Jacks or Better Multi-Strike. One class only. Multi-Strike is a four-line game where you play all four lines at the outset, and you earn the right to play higher lines by winning on the lower lines. So to play the game well, you need four separate strategies. For the lower line has a different strategy than the second line, then the third line, and then the top line. The Jacks or Better Multi-Strike returns 99.9%. It's the highest paying game in the casino. This entire schedule of free classes may be found on bobdancer.com. At the Palms, every Friday, it's a drawing where 10 people share $10,000 with the top prize equal to $3,000. You don't need to be there, but you need to claim by midnight. Multiple drawing entries occur Friday afternoon and Friday evening. They have play for prizes at a 0.2% rate. You can earn until this Friday Lowe's gift card, and then Monday through Friday for the following 2 weeks, Macy's gift cards. On Saturday evening, 7 to 10 p.m. in October, you redeem double points for video poker, 10 times points for slots. Single points are worth 0.25%, so double points is 0.5%. At videopoker.com, it's the best place to play lots of games. If you sign up for the Gold membership, $8.95 a month or $79.95 a year, this allows you to get correction on most games. It's a good place to practice quick quads, for example. They have a weekly contest this week. It is 100 play with Super Times Pay. Super Times Pay is a 6-coin per line game where approximately every 15 hands you get a multiplier between 2x and 10x. The game adds about 0.25% in EV to the base game with no change in the strategy necessary. All right. Richard, some 33 years ago, you appeared in a theater here in Las Vegas, and apparently you made a commitment that every 33 years you would be in a theater production again. So that happened the last two weekends. Tell us about it.
Yeah, so 33 years ago when I lived here, I did a production of The Lark at UNLV at the Judy Bailey Theater, and just wrapped up Much Ado About Nothing at, through the Nevada Conservatory Theater, which is at the Judy, which is at UNLV. So yeah, just finished that show, had a lot of fun.
You can do it again in another 33 years?
Yeah, another 33 years, I'll be back.
Mark your calendars, all casino shift bosses who want to know what Richard looks like when he's in his 90s, make sure you check that out. Right. He actually played Antonio, which is a brother of one of the leads, uncle of two of the others. And it's mostly a nothing part, except there's this one scene where he gets to play the human equivalent of a little Chihuahua challenging a Great Dane who's much younger than he is. Through the magic of makeup and good acting, they made Richard look like a short 60-year-old man challenging this real studly guy.
I could have taken him.
You could have taken him. Yeah, it sure looked like him from the part. I thought that was cool. All right. So if people want to...
Ryan, we welcome your questions. We encourage your questions at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com, or you can put them on facebook.com/gamblingwithanedge, or you can tweet them at us at RWM21. If you want the show delivered to you automatically every week as you sleep, you can sign up to do that at iTunes, YouTube, Stitcher, or at my site, richardmunchkin.com. And to find an archive of all the old shows, you can find that at bobdancer.com.
All right, very good. We thank Jeffrey Compton. We thank John Finkel, Richard, Go out and hit lots of royal flushes, everybody. Good day.
You've been listening to Gambling with an Edge with your hosts, Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin. Subscribe to the show in iTunes, and episodes will be delivered to you automatically every week. Archived versions of past shows may be found at bobdancer.com and richardmunchkin.com. We welcome emails at gamblingwithanedge@gmail.com. Bob Dancer and Richard Munchkin are both available on Facebook and welcome your questions. The sponsors for the show are the South Point Hotel, Casino, and Spa, the M Resort, the Palms Casino Resort, and the website videopoker.com. Join us again next week for another Gambling with an Edge.
Views and opinions expressed on this program were those of the hosts and guests and did not necessarily reflect those of Vegas All Net Radio, its affiliates, or its parent company.